Hey, it's Jordan, and I've got a podcast for you. Commons is Canada's most popular podcast about politics. Last season, they tried to answer the question, how corrupt is Canada? This time around, they're investigating our national addiction, oil. The current season featuring host Archie Mann is called Crude, and it's about Canada's relationship with the oil industry. The good, the bad, the ugly, and the weird. You'll find Commons wherever you get your podcasts, so go check it out. We open today with a recording of a language that no human civilization ever spoke. Yet most of you are going to understand some of it.
Zadrizes buzdaris kosdaur.
Sitraji valire.
Nigeitai neres gel masmo entar gerio lentrot. En valeria wepo anagarixan. Drakaris.
See, if you want to get a handle on why we're spending a Friday talking about a TV show, remind yourself that Game of Thrones created a language that people who snickered at dragons in high school can speak. The show's final season debuts this Sunday night at 9 p.m., and that, in itself, is significant. In a world where we're used to media being delivered on demand to each of us whenever we find the time to watch it. On one hand, Game of Thrones has been the first of its kind, a blockbuster fantasy epic adapted not to film, but to television, that broke the mold for these stories and brought adult fantasy to a very lucrative global audience. It has changed that industry. And on the other hand, it is also the last of a species, the television event that the world watches and talks about together, and that doesn't really happen anymore. In that sense, Game of Thrones is a dinosaur and the industry has changed around it. So what happened 8 years ago when this show debuted that made this possible? Why did it happen with this story? What will be left behind in the world of television when it's over? How has it changed both the stories that we tell and the mediums that we use to tell them? Oh, and who's going to end up on the damn Iron Throne? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and
there is only one war that matters, the Great War, and it is here.
Andre Demise is a writer for various publications. He's one of our favorite guests here on The Big Story. He knows a little something about Game of Thrones. Why did Game of Thrones, of all shows, change so much?
I think your frame of reference, if you happened to be tangentially into the fantasy genre, your frame of reference was most likely The Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter. And regardless of the fact that both Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter had very wide fan bases and people really loved and enjoyed both the movies, and well, maybe people less enjoyed the Lord of the Rings books because, let's be honest, they were pretty dry, there was at least an understanding that this was not necessarily meant with an adult audience in mind. J.K. Rowling did not write the Harry Potter books for adults. They were very clearly kids' books. J.R.R. Tolkien, even though you could say that it was a very mature high fantasy series, it was also written with young people in mind. A Game of Thrones comes from that the post-1970s Dungeons & Dragons genre, where these are very mature stories. It involves mature themes, blood and guts and sword and sorcery and all that stuff.
Written for a cult audience.
Written for an audience of 20-something guys that would get together around somebody's kitchen table on a Saturday afternoon and drink beer and play a role-playing game. Like, that's sort of the culture that it spawns out of. So I think that people were looking for a more mature fantasy product to just watch and enjoy. And Game of Thrones really, really hit that mark. People, when they were describing the show early on, weren't talking about a Game of Thrones in reference to other fantasy series. They were talking about how different Game of Thrones was from other fantasy series that they'd ever heard of, to the extent that they were saying things like, you know, this is The Sopranos with swords, or this is The Wire, but with magic.
My partner hates fantasy stories and hates magic and dragons and stuff. Yeah. And I knew that this was going to be something different when I essentially told her, look, I know you don't have to watch this with me, but this is an adaptation of a book I love. So I'm going to sit down and watch it anyway. You're welcome to join me or not.
Yeah.
And she joined me for the first episode and has watched every single episode multiple times since then.
Yeah.
And that's when it became clear that this was something else.
The fact that people will spend time rewatching it, and it's not just happening in the run-up to the last season. Every season that comes out, I see people on social media, and I know people that will simply rewatch the entire series just so that they can be caught up. It is a very complicated story with a lot of moving parts and a lot of different characters. But I don't think they would actually do that if they didn't really, really, really enjoy this show. And I think it's so enjoyable, like, to the idea, to the fact that you would rewatch 5 or 6 different seasons just to prepare yourself for the upcoming season. Like, that's, I can't think of another show that's done that.
When did it become clear that this was going to be the defining television show of this era?
I think it was probably around The Red Wedding in the third season.
My king has married and I owe my new queen a wedding gift.
Because I think people were not entirely sold on season 1 and season 2. But I think if you were either a book reader who knew what was going to happen at the end of season 3, or you were a show watcher during season 4 that was trying to get other people hooked on it, I think that plot twist at the end of season 3, where basically like the king that people believed was promised was brutally executed, and his wife was executed, and his mother, who basically held the family together, was executed... I think that's when people began to preach the gospel of the show. Like, this is just not what you're expecting when you turn on the TV and watch a fantasy series.
And once that happened, what did Game of Thrones change?
I think it made fantasy cool, which is weird because as a comic book guy and a fantasy reader and somebody who was really into sci-fi when I was younger, I never would have thought that was going to happen. But fantasy became a really cool genre to watch on TV and in film and to share with your friends. I could have never imagined that. Back when I was growing up, you didn't carry your comics around with you in public. You didn't talk about like whether you like the X-Men or the Avengers or the Justice League more. Like, you didn't have those conversations in the cafeterias. You kept that to yourself and your comic book friends.
Now you have them in the workplace.
Yeah. You
can, and on podcasts.
Chat to anybody about, you know, how much you love superhero movies on podcasts. That's just a thing people do with no shame whatsoever. If you, oh my gosh. Here's the thing. So my fiance and I, one of the ways that we bonded was over how much we like comic book movies and anime. Like,
right.
She's a huge anime geek, and this is stuff that we talked about. And I remember on our maybe like 8th or 9th date, and we were, I forget what show we were talking about, but we were talking about some anime series. I just remember thinking to myself, like, this could have never happened like 10 or 12 years ago. Like, if you bring up how much you like anime or comic book films or sci-fi stuff or fantasy stuff, that's a wrap. Like, you had to really like look inside the circles of people that you like played anime tabletop or played tabletop games with or had like an anime club with, like you kind of...
It was very insular.
Talked about it inside of those circles, but you didn't bring that outside of that. That's something that you hid. Like, you kind of kept that as your... And you just like, you eventually talked about it in the relationship. Like, oh yeah, I also happen to be into this stuff. And you just kind of cringed and hoped that they were going to accept it. And now it's just, it's so widely accepted that I think in some ways it's had a negative effect on the culture, not as a whole, but I mean, it's had a negative effect on people who grew up in the culture. I think a lot of people who, you know, were like fantasy and sci-fi geeks growing up, they're kind of like, but you didn't have to go through the kind of pain that I went through,
right,
in enjoying this stuff. Like, a lot of young people who kind of, if you grew up with like Steven Universe, or you grew up with the Game of Thrones, or you grew up with Harry Potter and so forth, and everybody loves it and talks about it, they didn't experience the kind of pain that you went through as a young person being into this stuff. And I think that's kind of what's causing a bit of a backlash. It's not because people are really trying to like protect the culture or gatekeep the culture. It's because they want everyone to experience the kind of pain that they did to really be a fan.
Yeah, you can't love it if you haven't suffered for your love of it.
Which is absolutely ridiculous. Like, I don't want anyone to suffer to like the same stuff that I do.
No, I want more people to like it.
Because the more people that like it, then the more good stuff gets published. And I talked about this in a Globe and Mail article that I wrote recently, just sort of reflecting on the success of the show. And one of the good things that it did was throw open the floodgates. And you have a wide array of authors who I think are addressing a lot of shortcomings that existed in the fantasy genre. One of the huge shortcomings in the fantasy genre is that it's incredibly Eurocentric. So, you know, this is not to say that George R. R. Martin is a bad writer or that he's racist or something like that. But if you read the books, there's just, if you're not a white guy, you're going to have a hard time finding somebody that you can truly relate to. You can put yourself in a character's shoes, but they're not going to reflect you. I don't think necessarily that's the most important part of writing a story, but I think it is an important part. And, you know, you see authors like Tannen Revdu, you see like Nkedi Okorafor, N.K. Jemisin. There's so many more people now, Toye Adeyemi, that can write amazing fantasy stories and now find an audience, whereas that was incredibly difficult to do when I was growing up. Like, I had to go really seeking out black fantasy authors, and I think I was introduced to Afro fantasy through Octavia Butler, who hardly anybody at the time was also a reader of. You have people like Nalo Hopkinson, who who, you know, writes incredible Afrofuturist stories, but then doesn't get the kind of accolades, I think, in her early years that she could have achieved now that Game of Thrones has thrown open the floodgates. The other sort of downside to it, though, is that it ended up, I think, saturating the book publishing market to an extent that it ended up driving down book sales. Like, people are flocking towards this one book property, but they're not paying attention to the others. So at least from the statistics that I've looked at, there has been a drop in fantasy book sales. But then that's been sort of picked up by an increase in digital book sales and self-publishing sales.
And so, that's where you find those.
Yeah, like
new
a lot
voices.
Of people who sort of bypass the agency route and bypass the publisher route and simply, you know, upload their story to Amazon eBooks. If you have a great story in mind and you know how to finish a novel, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do, and you want to find an audience, I think it's easier now than it ever has been. So with the amount of people that are sort of going around that obstacle of traditional publishing, readers are just lapping this stuff up. And I think A Game of Thrones, or rather A Song of Ice and Fire, which is the name of the book series, I think does deserve a lot of the credit for that. And I think the shortcomings in that book series are just being picked up by other very talented authors.
What about as a TV show? Because I'm always wondering, and maybe this is me because I'm getting old and lame. This is the only show that I will make a date with. Like, I will be there at 9 p.m. on Sunday watching HBO. Everything else I stream and watch whenever I have the time.
You know what? I think, yeah, you're right. Because there's not really any other show that I would say, Sunday night, I'm not doing anything else. Don't call me. Don't ask me to make plans with you. I'm in front of the TV watching Game of Thrones. That, I think, maybe like The Walking Dead had that power for a little while, but it just dragged on too long. And I think the self-terminating nature of Game of Thrones, like knowing that this is going to wrap up and end somehow, that everybody wants to find out together how this all ends, versus a show that sort of just like shuffles off slowly into the sunset long after it's worn out its welcome. I think that once the show wraps up, that ability to captivate an audience and bring them in front of the television to all like sit down and watch and live tweet together and talk about, you know, your reactions to it the next day, I can't think of another TV property that can do that.
Well, after Game of Thrones began, shortly after, I might get the timing wrong, but that was when Netflix and other streaming services started binge dumping, right? So
yeah.
They would dump like House of Cards and newer shows like You or whatever, but they all show up at once. So you watch it when you can.
At the time that A Game of Thrones was released, I think the only property that I can remember that was on Netflix as a binge streaming property was a terrible urban horror show called Hemlock Grove. And that was pretty much it. Everything else was, you know, movies that had long sort of shuffled off into like a digital ghetto where I guess the publishers didn't really care whether it was just available on demand. You didn't really see like the A-list stuff on Netflix at that time. And yeah, you had like older TV shows that you could rewatch, but you didn't have new content. So I think A Game of Thrones came at a very fortuitous time where, again, that sort of episodic week-by-week TV watching that cultivated audiences for, say, Mad Men, for The Wire, etc. Like, it sort of existed in that vein, and that was slowly, I think, killed off by Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon. All I can hear about, like, when I log on to Twitter or, you know, go read TV reviews, is about this new series that just dropped that you can watch all at once, if you wanted to, over a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's had a negative effect on the genre. Because I think that writing for an episodic week-by-week series takes a level of consideration for the audience that doesn't quite exist if you can just drop everything at once. So right. You have to bring those viewers back on a week-by-week basis. And if those ratings start to drop off, you know that changes have to be made. When you binge dump everything into the Netflix queue at once, you've already written the entire story. There's no feedback there to be had whatsoever. So I can't think of anything else right now that would draw viewers back. And I think we're heading into right now, I don't like it. Like, I think it's cool to like talk with your friends about the show that you binged over the weekend, but I don't think it's really sustainable. I mean, people have lives, they grow up, they have families, they have other things to look forward to. Finding one TV show to bond with other people with, yeah, that's hard. It's tough.
So when did it become that must-see appointment television that everybody was going to sit down and watch together and tweet about? What was the first sign we had that this was that kind of show?
2 points. When Jaime Lannister pushes Bran Stark out of the window of that tower.
He saw us. It's all right, it's all right, it's all right.
He saw us!
I heard you the first time.
How old are you, boy?
10.
10. The things I do for love.
And, I remember people's reaction to that happening. How could he do that? That's just something that you're not used to in a medieval fantasy story. Like, you didn't see stuff like that. And then when Ned Stark was beheaded before the Great Sept of Baelor.
Bring me his head.
Seeing people's reactions filmed, because, you know, book readers, I think, for Game of Thrones are a very generous bunch. Like, they want other people to watch and enjoy the show and be as shocked and appalled as they were. So
we didn't say anything.
We didn't say a word. We kept it to ourselves. And when people were talking about, oh my gosh, he's going to get out of this dungeon and get his revenge against that mean Cersei lady, and then he was beheaded. Seeing the YouTube reactions of people just like gasping and I remember one of my coworkers had one of the most viral reactions. Her boyfriend filmed her watching the execution scene and the scream that she let out when he was beheaded, that carried the video viral. And I think that sort of captures what it's like as a book reader who enjoys the show, why the show caught on so well and what moment that was. And then you just had like cliffhanger after cliffhanger, which didn't resolve in the good guys winning. Like it just progressively got worse and worse and worse. And I think by around probably season 5, that's when people were like, listen, like if good stuff doesn't start to happen, we riot. Like yeah. Sansa Stark being married off to Ramsay Bolton, you know, like the entire Stark lineage pretty much being either wiped out or scattered.
That's the other thing I want to talk to you about. Because yeah, there's like an arc of seasons 1 to 5 where everything just keeps getting worse and worse, like you said. And there was
some really dark stuff that happened. I think the show's dependence on torture and rape scenes to evoke viewer reactions. I think it started to get a little bit hackneyed and people were starting to revolt. So I can understand why some people swore off the show. They said, you know what, that's it. I'm checking out. This is good. I'm good. At the same time, I think that around when they announced that they're going to be doing less episodes per season and when the story naturally had to swing around to, okay, so now let's actually see like our favorite characters who have been enduring so much pain and loss and horror, let's have them start winning. So when like Jon and Sansa Stark, for example, and Daenerys Targaryen, like when their storylines start to pan out and they start winning, I think that's when it sort of picked up that steam again where people really, really want to see how the show ends because now we're so heavily invested in the few original characters that are left that you wonder who's going to end up on the Iron Throne. My prediction? Nobody. Nobody's going to win. Everybody's going to die.
Everybody's going to die.
Everybody, I think, is going to die. Yeah. They're going to die noble deaths, but they're going to die.
So what happens? How does the show end? Just fades out on an empty chair?
Well, George R. R. Martin himself has mused that his ending that he sees for the book series is basically like this like windswept graveyard with like snow blowing over, I believe he said tombstones, but I could be wrong here. But he was basically just imagining a desolation where winter has swept over the whole land. And that's kind of the direction that I see it going. I think it's almost, at this point, it's almost immaterial who ends up on the Iron Throne when you have this like gigantic army that is self-replenishing through the people that they kill. I can't see how this works out for anybody. Like even if you somehow manage to take down the Night's King, does that mean the army of White Walkers and the zombie whites that they bring in behind them, do they pass away too? I don't think so. I don't think it's going to end well.
There is no other property out there, not speaking about geek properties specifically, but there's no other property in which the actual maps and histories and lineage, people
listen,
dig into this the way people dig into the Bible.
Yeah. I have the guidebook to the to the Song of Ice and Fire world. Like I have that book at home and I occasionally will leaf through it just to find new things. And you're right. It's almost like picking up and reading the Bible just to find new things. And it is kind of bizarre, actually. Like this all sprung out of somebody's imagination that other fans have expanded on over the course of decades. But it's also pretty cool. And I think it's encouraging that if people will tune in for this, which is, it doesn't completely come out of nowhere. Like it is inspired by real life events and real monarchies and real histories. And I'm really hoping that what that leads to is other authors who have the same sort of mindset where I want to take something that's relatively true to life, but apply it to my fantasy world, I would very much like to see this pan out. For example, I've seen authors like Guy Gavriel Kay write voluminous stories about Chinese dynasties. Marlon James just released a book, Black Leopard, Red Wolf, which he intends to write as a trilogy. That was picked up for adaptation by Michael B. Jordan, who you might know as Killmonger from the Black Panther movie.
Yeah.
You know, so I would love to see this thrive and continue, and I want to see more cultures represented, because if this is people's introduction to history, as fake as it is, I'm at least hoping that they will divert into the real thing and study actual histories, because it is interesting. Like, there is no story that can be made up, I think, that's more interesting than what has actually happened here in our real lives. And being a bit of a history buff myself, it kind of makes me happy that people are interested in this.
Are we ever going to read the end of this story, or are we just going to have to settle for watching it?
Oh, this is the most depressing question.
That's why I saved it for last.
Yeah, I would very much like to see the last two books published in the next few. Like, I would just be over the moon if the last couple of books could get published, especially before the prequel series comes out that we just talked about. But the one outcome that I'm afraid will happen, and if you are a Wheel of Time reader out there in the audience listening to this, you'll understand. The outcome that I hope will not happen is that Brandon Sanderson will have to finish the series for George R.R. Martin.
Thanks, Andre. And by the way, Arya Stark's going to win.
I certainly hope not. I like her, but I definitely hope not.
Andre Demise, writer, pop culture critic, host of Black Tea on this podcast network, hopefully wrong about the ending of Game of Thrones. That was The Big Story. For more from us, find us at thebigstorypodcast.ca or at thebigstoryfpn on Twitter and at Frequency Pods on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. You can subscribe and rate us and review us wherever you get your podcasts. We love it when you do that. Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever, doesn't matter. Claire Brassard is the lead producer for The Big Story. Ryan Clark and Stephanie Phillips are our associate producers. And Alisa Nielsen is our digital editor. And I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show. We'll talk on Monday.